The Orange FM.
Let's say that again. Let's Voltron. Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, and I am your host for this week's podcast. We have a unique show for you today. This is something that you have never seen before on the Let's Voltron podcast. First of all, I want to talk about Chitoy has posted another picture. We had talked on the last podcast about the Olympics and about how the Olympic rings all are the same colors of Voltron. And that inspired Chitoy to do an Olympic Voltron who is snowboarding. So if you see this, she posted it to the Facebook page for Let's Voltron. It basically shows the Voltron holding the snowboard, and at the bottom of the snowboard, you see there's a design of Blazing Sword. So I encourage you guys to go out on the Let's Voltron podcast Facebook page and check that out. Also, this week, we had introduced to us from World Events Productions the Voltron 30th Anniversary logo was introduced, and you'll be seeing that all year in 2014. That logo is now, I think it's the image that you see when you go to the Twitter account for @Voltron and also on the Voltron official Facebook page. Now I'd like to introduce you to someone who has a very unique perspective on Voltron, someone who is growing up in the Voltron Force generation. My son, Lucas. Welcome to Let's Voltron, Lucas.
Hello.
All right. Lucas, tell me something. When was the first time that you really saw Voltron for the first time?
Probably when I got the comic books for my birthday last year.
All right, but no, it was even before that, wasn't it?
When we were watching the episodes.
Right, a Voltron Force. So you were about how old then?
Six, seven,
eight. Right? Yeah, so the first time that you ever saw Voltron forming, where they said, let's go Voltron Force, what was that like?
Well, I had in my head, well, if they have more episodes coming, do they have to say that every single time?
All right. Well, did you think it was too long of a process for them to form Voltron? Is that it?
Well, seeing that it's a million foot robot, it's not that bad at all.
Yeah, million foot, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't Daniel say that one time?
No, that was Lance.
Oh, it was Lance. Oh, yeah, that's right.
36 seconds is not long.
Lance being snarky and everything, he didn't like it when Daniel said it took 36 seconds to form Voltron. And then, well, you know, we're forming a million-foot robot. I think, you know, it should take a little bit of time, right? Yeah. Guess who we have with us today?
We have Brian Smith, author of all the Voltron comic books.
The Voltron Force comic books from Viz Media, right?
Yes.
The 6-volume graphic novel set that came out that was a supplement to the animated series, right?
Yeah, it was like an add-on.
Brian Smitty Smith, welcome to Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast.
I'm here. Thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this all week.
Great. Now, Brian, I've talked to you before at New York Comic Con. We did an interview with you for Toon Barn.
Yes.
And you were there with Jacob and Tracy. And this was just when everything was really getting launched for your comic book series, right?
Yeah, that was pretty much right at the beginning.
Right. You've had the opportunity to be on some Voltron panels at the conventions and things like that, right?
Yeah. As a result of writing the Voltron Force comics, the people from Viz, if I'm ever at a show that they're doing a panel either with Jeremy or like, you know, a kids comics panel, they've been nice enough to invite me on board.
So what do you get that excitement that, you know, the surge of Voltron fandom that comes together when people are at these conventions?
Oh, absolutely. And the best thing about the Voltron Force comics was, you know, I grew up, you know, watching Voltron on television, and, you know, a lot of people of my, you know, generation now have children. So it's kind of like they get to continue the Voltron story with their kids. So I get a lot of like parents and kids that are kind of all coming together and enjoying Voltron at the same time because of the new series.
Right. Could you describe for us, like, what are some of the things that fans ask you all the time?
I don't get asked that many questions. You know, occasionally on Twitter, somebody will hit me up and ask me something. I've been getting a lot more questions lately, actually, about the 30th anniversary encyclopedia and, like, you know, what kind of stuff we're planning for that. But the majority of questions we get, or at least on panels, they primarily deal with, like, the older cast, like the original five pilots, and, like, how they relate to the Voltron Force kids, you know.
Do you think at this point there has been more people that are coming together based on the 30th anniversary of Voltron from the original series?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you think there is a new generation that is based on this Voltron Force series and your comic?
I mean, in a perfect world, I think it's both. You know, I think that there are people that, I mean, it's strange. Even if you have a passing familiarity with Voltron, like, you know, it's an imagery from your childhood, when you see it again, you just remember how cool it was. You know, like, you see the Voltron robot. It's so iconic and so, like, I think with a lot of people who maybe haven't thought about Voltron in a while, when they see it brought up on comic book message boards or, you know, like the anniversary toys that, you know, that Maddie Collector's doing, I think it really does re-spark that interest and enthusiasm they had when they were a kid. And, like, all that material's out there so they could, like, you know, secretly play with that stuff with their kids now, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Lucas has a Blazing Sword Voltron that he plays with.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like it?
I love it.
Is that the one with the talking box? The one that...
Yeah. Yes. I got it for Christmas.
Cool.
And that has, like, 30 points of articulation, so you can put them in whatever pose you want.
Now,
you can have them in normal form and then just have the feet going the wrong way.
Right. Did you guys, do the collector set, like the from Maddie Toys when they released all five lines?
I actually didn't get a chance to get all those. I didn't get on that board quick enough.
Yeah, me neither.
We are going to be picking up the new Toynami 30th anniversary Voltron.
Oh, that thing is sweet. I saw pictures of it online. Cool.
And we are looking forward to getting that set shipped to us because that has everything with it, and it's die-cast.
Yeah, which is great.
And I can't wait to have Lucas play with that.
Now, a couple years ago, I was in a comic shop, right when, like, I just started working on the Voltron stuff again, and I you know, I was watching all the episodes of Go Lion and watching episodes of you know, Voltron, Defender of the Universe, and I was in this comic store, and they had this. It was like a vinyl. It was like 2.5 feet tall. It was huge. It was like a Shogun Warriors scale, like Voltron.
Right.
Yeah, and I looked at it, and I'm like, oh, that would be so great to own that, but it's literally the size of, like, a dog. Like, it would be like having another person in my apartment, so I decided against it.
It's 2 feet tall.
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge.
Yeah.
You got to take that out for walks.
And Toynami has talked about making another version of that Shogun Warrior-type Voltron.
That's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful, but I live in a very small apartment in New Jersey. Voltron would get his mail delivered here.
Why don't we go back a little bit and let's talk about how you first got involved with doing Voltron comics in the first place.
Sure. I was freelance editing some new comic book work from Nickelodeon. Nickelodeon has their offices on the West Coast as Nick Animation Studio. And then here in New York, they have what's called Nickelodeon Creative Resources, which is basically like their in-house ad department. And they also run all the publishing stuff through there. So I was helping them, like, the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comic that came out through IDW, the Avatar comics that came out through Dark Horse. Because I had some previous editorial experience working as an editor at Marvel Comics, and I had worked at Nickelodeon previously as a character art manager, I was brought in to kind of help them navigate, like, the world of getting these comics up and running and off the ground.
Okay.
another comic property that Nickelodeon owned called Winx, Winx Club, which was
one of the worst.
I had never heard of it before that. I think it was a European property, Italian. And Nickelodeon had bought the rights either exclusively or just to distribute that material here in the United States. And Viz was doing the comics based on that. So that's how I met Tracy at a meeting in New York to discuss it. And me and Tracy Todd, the editor of the Voltron Force comics, we just hit it off right away. We have a very similar love of, like, you know, 80s cartoons and comics. And it was really great working with her on all that stuff, like helping Viz get that Winx Club comic up and running.
Right.
And then, you know, I'm also a freelance writer and artist. I've written a bunch of comics. I draw my own comics. So when the Voltron Force comics license came up, I left Nickelodeon to just get back into, like, writing and drawing full time. And Tracy approached me about, you know, getting on board as writer of the Voltron Force stuff. And I just jumped at the chance. I mean, it's a great opportunity to get to contribute something to, like, a cherished childhood memory. You know, it's like this thing, Voltron was very influential to me, you know, so the opportunity to work on new comics based on the new series, I said yes 100 times.
Yes.
I believe there's an email with 100 yeses. I could forward that to you.
Wow.
But yeah,
okay.
And you know, she had me write up a couple of ideas, like, you know, some real quick pitches, with the focus being on the cadets and, like, trying to not necessarily fit in between specific episodes of the TV show, but, like, reflect events of the TV show and kind of have a separate, like, overarching continuity for the first 6 volumes. So, like, you know, the characters that appear in the first volume, the second volume, we're going to revisit them, you know, at a later time within this 6-book set.
So, but within that framework, you could still say that these were, like, unique episodes, sort of like the television show, right?
Yeah, one of the highest compliments that I received on this stuff, and I was a nervous wreck when I first turned it in, because, you know, anytime you have to work on a licensed character, you know, there are people that work at the company that own the character that are very very protective, and rightfully so. They want to make sure that this stuff reflects what they see, what they want the property to you know, the things that they want to boast and push to the forefront.
Absolutely.
So, you know, anytime you just, like, kind of start floating ideas by, I was expecting, like, you know, thumbs down and, you know, you'll never get it, Smitty, get lost. But it was good. You know, the highest compliment I received on the books was from Jeremy, who told me that, you know, they could stand alone as episodes. They could easily fit within the TV show they were working on. And that's exactly what we were going for. So it's good.
Did anybody ever say, before we even knew whether there was going to be a second season or not, did anybody ever say, hey, these would be, you know, perfect for making into episodes that we actually want to show on TV?
No, Jeremy was always so supportive. Jeremy Cray, for, I guess, people who are listening to the Voltron, Let's Voltron podcast know who Jeremy is. But
yes.
Anyway, he was 100% supportive of everything that I was doing, and was very complimentary across the board. So, you know, definitely, like, I would touch base with him, he would touch base with me, and if there was going to be more TV shows, you know, there it would have been great to be involved with them. But, you know, getting the chance to work on the comics was a dream itself, so.
Right. Had you ever talked to Todd Garfield about any of this while you were doing your research?
You know, I don't recall. There was a few phone calls very early on where it was, like, a group of people in St. Louis, or, you know, a group of people wherever on a conference call. Me here in my apartment, Tracy out in San Diego, or San Francisco, rather, it is, and then Jeremy, and then some other assorted people. So it's quite possible that he was on the line on one of those calls, but I honestly don't remember.
All right. So at what point was the animated show at when you were starting to do your work?
They had already completed a bunch of episodes, but it had not yet aired on Nickelodeon yet. So I hadn't seen any of the episodes. They had sent me a bunch of scripts, which was great. And I used a lot of that information in the scripts to, you know, to base my take on the characters and, like, you know, what was not directly, you know, contradict anything that they were building in the TV show. Kind of like, you know, using it as a roadmap to build the comics in a way that it would, like, dovetail with the episodes.
All right, because the reason I asked that is because we saw elements of Awesome Tron in a couple of your stories.
Yes.
And did you even know what Awesometron looked like at that point?
No.
So that was a pretty good guess drawing.
No, I think by the time the artist had to draw it, they had the material to provide him for reference.
Right. But, so there was probably a character designer who had posted some of those to the artists,
yeah,
right?
Probably, yes.
Okay. All right. So when you were thinking up your first idea, you had to come up with the whole six-story arc in your head first before you could break it up into six different volumes, right?
I think, you know, I'll have to go back and check the documents, but that first, I kind of wrote the first and last book as bookends in my head, like when I first started. And some of the other stories within, like 2 through 5, I think there was 3 or 4 ideas that they just said, oh, we can't do that. So like they were always kind of moving, like those ideas were fluctuating in the middle. But there were certain touchstones that I definitely wanted to bring forward, like the Tournament of Lions was a very early idea. You know, the notion that there's a galaxy full, a universe filled with aliens that are all kind of looking at Voltron as the defender of the universe and wondering, you know, where our representation in this is. You know, that was an idea that came to me pretty early on. The Dragon Dawn episode, I think, issue, that was part of another issue at first. Like that was a subplot that was running along another story that I had in mind. But everybody seemed to like it, so we just kind of pushed it to the fore and ditched the original plot and made that the main book.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so all those characters and those worlds that were talked about in Tournament of Lions with Drazik and all those other characters, those were all made up by you, right?
Yeah. Like that Elder Council and the three, kind of like their three candidates for, you know, to join the Voltron Force. Was it Prince Nebulax, Kyborg, and Dagger?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's pretty good. I remembered my own characters.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and was there ever really a sense that there were other systems in the universe that felt like they weren't getting their just due defense from Voltron?
Now, you know, I'd be hard-pressed to find an episode of the TV show where that's, like, addressed directly, like, where there's some kind of, like, you know, hey, Voltron, like, you know, we're getting our butts kicked over here, and you never seem to come to our planet. But nevertheless, I thought it was an interesting idea to pursue. Like, what if there was this, like, discontent in somewhere in the universe with people that are looking at Voltron and they see the power there. They see, like, you know, what Voltron represents, and they want a bigger role in what Voltron does.
Right. I guess I would feel kind of like, well, yeah, Aris does get most of the defense because they're right there.
Yeah.
And maybe Earth and maybe some of the other planets that were involved with the original creation of Voltron, like Balto,
uh-huh.
Ariel, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Aris will, you know, Aris is always going to be a big bullseye planet just because, you know, it's no secret that that's where they keep the lions, you know, so obviously, like, there's going to be an inordinate amount of attacks on planet Aris.
Right, but at any point, you could just create another world, and you could say, all right, Voltron's starting this episode by defending, you know, from the Drool Empire or whatever other forces they could be facing at the time. Mm-hmm. And you could start your episode like that, right?
Sure.
Okay, so I mean, it's kind of nice. You can start an episode, you know, Voltron's in full action mode. You can have the action right at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, finish that off. You know, Blazing Sword comes out. That's done.
Yep.
All right, let's go back to Aris. Let's start over again, and you know, the new story starts.
Yep.
And that's pretty cool.
To some degree, I think we did that in the Tournament of Lions book, where it starts off with, like, a massive space battle.
Mm-hmm.
Voltron's responding to a distress call from an unknown ship. Obviously, they're going to defend this against, like, you know, the Drool Empire attack. Voltron's taken out in that, like, within the first 10 pages of that. He gets blasted with, like, this ion pulverizer cannon. And the whole thing was a setup. The whole thing was a trap. And
yeah.
By the end of that episode, by the time they get Voltron up and running again, the cadets have managed to, you know, rally the planet against, like, you know, the Elder Council. And it really is, in my mind anyway, it was a different kind of Voltron story, where like you said, like the formation of Voltron is not the culmination of the story. It's not the apex event. This is, like, we already see Voltron. Voltron's taken out now without Voltron to rely on. How good are these kids? Do they really deserve to be there? And by the end of the book, hopefully they did prove, to the reader at least, that they do deserve their role on the Voltron Force.
Right. And they get tested several times throughout your six-volume set.
Yeah.
Two of the people that you introduced to the whole series that really gave them their biggest test was Zora and Rosa, the Drool twins.
Yeah, they were a blast. I was very pleased that that idea got approved, just because I thought it would be finally like the three cadets would have their counterparts. They would have, like, you know, the way Lotor is like a peer to Allura and, you know, Keith and the rest of the pilots. The Voltron Force kids did not really have that personification enemy. They had a lot of row beasts and a lot of internal strife, proving themselves to the senior pilots. But they didn't really have like another group of, you know, humanoid enemies to kind of duel with. And that's something I tried to do in a couple of the books, like give them, you know, actual people that they would be in conflict with.
And how is it that we first meet them on Earth?
The entire, you know, well, by the end of that book, spoiler alert to anybody.
I think we're allowed to talk about it at this point.
It was only 2 years ago, but, you know.
Yeah.
The two twins are enrolled in the Galaxy Alliance Flight Academy. They're actually, like, you know, presented to the Galaxy Alliance as, like, a step forward in bringing peace between Planet Doom and the rest of the rest of the Galaxy Alliance. So they are enrolled in the classes. They're there. They're, like, you know, students as a goodwill gesture. But it turns out by the end of the story that they are actually plants. Like, they are nieces to Prince Lotor, the same way, like, Larmina is a niece to, you know, Princess Allura. And they're there to try and, like, you know, insert themselves into Voltron Force activity. Like, you know, they have... they get invited to Planet Eris. Like, you know, they're shown the Castle of Lions. They're, like, given a guided tour in the, you know, with Princess Allura putting, like, you know, the diplomatic relations between their planets before, like, kind of like the personal safety of, you know, they're not viewing them as a threat, but in fact they are a threat.
You had mentioned how Larmina was Allura's niece.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about that? Because I got to tell you, there's been so many times and Jeremy has been asked this so many times,
right.
And they called it like Larmina Gate, you know, and all this. So what is your take on how Larmina is Allura's niece?
Meaning, like, does Princess Allura have like sisters or brothers that we've never seen before?
Yeah. And how King Alphor is her grandfather.
Yeah. It's, I don't know exactly. I've always kind of looked at it as like a, Huey, Dewey and Louie situation.
Uh-huh.
Where, you know, they're, Donald's their uncle, but we don't really get into the specifics of it. But I mean,
right.
The most, if you're looking at it like logistically from like a you know, very practical perspective, I think the most obvious answer is that Larmina was adopted.
Okay.
That's my, I mean, like, if you really had to like nail it down to, okay, like this has to make sense somehow.
Right.
She was dropped on the castle door when she was a kid, or like her family was injured or killed by a Drool Empire attack, and like she was just brought into the castle because there was nowhere else to go.
Okay.
Again, that's not canon. That's not, like, you know, that's,
right.
That's my, it's own just... personal take on it. If I had to really explain it under, like, you know, in a court of law.
Hopefully it never gets to that point.
No.
All right. So if we start from the first book, we start with Shelter from the Storm.
Mm-hmm.
There was an interesting aspect to this that had never really been brought to people's attention. And I think this is really cool that you brought this out in each of the cadets in Shelter of the Storm.
Mm-hmm.
We find out what their deepest and darkest fears are.
Right.
And how did you go about determining which fear was the most prevalent for each of these cadets?
Well, you know, a lot of it I just drew from the Voltron Force scripts that they gave me, and, you know, just based it on the characterization that they were employing on the show. You know, it seemed it wasn't a very like it wasn't a very difficult you know discussion with World Event Productions or with Viz. I mean, like looking at the characters, Daniel is so arrogant and so cocky about like you know what he's doing, and like his biggest fear is that he's just gonna be overcome. Like he's gonna let that power go to his head, especially with the Hagerium infection, that he will not be able to control it, and that he will not only like fulfill what the teachers are telling him, that he's not a great, you know, he's not the best teammate. He's always looking after himself. Like that eventually will come, come back a thousandfold, and he'll be trapped, in this, you know, this kind of evil form. And he's going to ruin like everything. With Larmina, I think her biggest fear is that she's never going to live up to Princess Allura. You know, that level of, kindness and diplomacy and like, you know, her abilities, like, left to her own devices without Princess Allura, I think Larmina's biggest fear is that like Aeris will fall.
Right.
You know, she will not be able to defend it the way that her aunt did. She will not be able to do those same things because she's not good enough.
Okay.
And that's like, you know, that's like a kernel of fear that exists somewhere in her brain, that she's always like overcompensating. She's always doing more and being tougher than she has to because she feels that she's just not good enough.
Right.
And I think that also plays with Vince. You know, Vince is, out of the three cadets, definitely the one with the biggest insecurity issues. Like he is always like doubting his physical abilities. When he gets his Voltcom and it seems useless, like his Voltcom ability,
right?
He's always being like put in a position where he has to doubt his position within the team.
But yet he could have the strongest power out of all three of them.
Yeah, and over the course of the show, I think they really showed that like, you know, what seemed at first to be a weakness or like, you know, a kind of a nebulous, I don't know what I do, you know, power set, he eventually ends up, you know, being able to do amazing things. And I think with like the Green Lion, like in that book, he being entrusted with that, being entrusted like, okay, I'm on this path where eventually I'm going to pilot the Green Lion. I think that was terrifying to him because he was always so insecure. So like his biggest fear was that, okay, you gave me the Green Lion and now I've destroyed it. You know, I wasn't good enough.
And he sort of has the closest connection to Pidge from all of the cadets. So in a way he would sort of feel like because he would be Green Lion and he would be letting Pidge down. Yes. In a way if he didn't succeed.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And then at the very end of the episode, of course, we find out what King Lotor's biggest fear is.
Yeah, that was I think that's the only time we got to show Zarkon in the whole thing.
You go from Shelter from the Storm to Tournament of Lions,
mm-hmm.
And this is a nice little twist here. At some point, Voltron is incapacitated.
Yes.
And Pidge and Hunk are working on getting him back online.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, they've been challenged to basically fight for their right to be the Voltron Force against these other opponents.
Yes.
And, you know, is it ever in, I guess, Keith and Allura's mind that this should ever even be happening?
No. I think like the senior pilots, like they, well, you know, in the beginning of the Voltron Force cartoon series, you know, Lance and Pidge and Hunk are all working at the Flight Academy.
Right.
So like they've had like, you know, their eyes on like all of the cadets coming through, you know, so technically they've been doing this already. They've been weeding out potential candidates that they can trust with the Voltron Lions. So when they arrive at Daniel and Vince, in my mind, it's like, yeah, these are the guys that have been doing it the longest. These kids are the ones that we need, and we're gonna get them on board. We're gonna get them involved.
At one point in your comic book, it says, Laura says that Destiny has chosen these three, and
mm-hmm.
you know, we didn't decide this. Destiny chose this. How is it that these three were chosen in the first place?
I mean, without like going into like the. Like
right.
The King Alphor connection between, you know, him and Vince. Vince seems to have some special connection to King Alphor, which I don't really think is ever fully explained or revealed in the series. Is there an episode that I'm not thinking of?
No, it's that's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's never really understood as to how Vince has the same ancient power that Voltron has.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, without some stuff that we're talking about, like it will be touched upon in the encyclopedia. Right. So I don't want to give away too much, but like there is some logic to what she's saying. Like there is like a spiritual connection between like certain people and, you know, the Voltron robot.
Okay. All right. So they get to this other world, and they've got Voltron, and they can't do anything with him. And they get challenged to enter this tournament, and Larmina and Vince and Daniel can't avoid, you know, not getting involved in this.
Yeah.
So they leave the rest of the Voltron force to go participate in this.
Right. Because they view it as like their only opportunity to prove themselves, and also the only way to save the rest of the team, because they've all fallen into this trap. So I think that there's a scene where they're explicitly told to not go to this tournament. And because they're told to not go, they absolutely do go.
Right.
Yeah. So
right.
It's the whole thing is a trap. They know it. They know that like they've built this, you know, insane obstacle course. They've put these other three candidates in that group specifically to eliminate, you know, the cadets, to eliminate Daniel, Vince, and Larmina. And once they're out of the picture, once they've proven that like these kids were not chosen by destiny, or like, you know, they're no more special than anybody else, they'll be able to insert their three cadets into the Voltron Force program by force, if necessary, and, you know, they'll get a bigger say in Voltron's activities.
Yeah, I can't imagine how they would have thought that Keith, Allura, Pidge, Hunk, and Lance would have been okay with that.
No, you know, it's like they present a pretty, from their side anyway, from the Elder Council side, a pretty compelling argument, like, well, this has always been the way it's been, and we think it's time for a change. You know, so obviously I don't think the Voltron Force pilots would adhere to that. They don't really cotton to ultimatums. They tend to, you know, view that type of ideology as a threat. You know, like you're trying to use this for your own power. We're using this to defend everybody. But, you know, it's pretty clear to us anyway that you guys just want to get your hands on Voltron so you can use it however you see fit. And that's not really the deal.
Right. And Larmina ends up being the one that really commands, you know, the attention of everybody with the help of Vince.
Yeah.
To be able to broadcast herself so that she can, you know, convince the other people, hey, we're the ones that deserve to be here, and we're the ones that are helping defend the universe. So, you know, join us and rise up against this.
Yeah. And that was an important part to me in that story, just because I really wanted to start showing Larmina as capable in that regard, as capable, you know, the following in her aunt's footsteps, like she does have the chops to eventually lead Planet Eris.
Yeah. All right. So after Tournament Alliance, we go to Twin Trouble.
Uh-huh.
And in Twin Trouble, we see, you know,
the debut of Rosa and Zora.
Yeah, and you know, the beginning of it starts with them going to Earth. And of course, Hunk can't wait for Taco Tuesday, right?
Yeah, I did it before the Lego Movie.
Yes, Tuesday. Yes, you did. That's I was thinking about that during the Lego Movie, and I was thinking, where have I heard Taco Tuesday before?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you did it. All right, so so they get to Earth, and Daniel has to be put through some tests.
Yeah, I mean, they're coming back to the Flight Academy. Vince and Daniel were members of the Flight Academy. Larmina was never trained there. She was trained on Planet Eris. But it's kind of like in Daniel's eyes, we're coming back as, like, you know, the conquering heroes. We're members of the Voltron Force. This is what everybody in the school wants to do, and we're doing it. So, you know, he's really looking forward to strutting his stuff and showing everybody just how great he is.
But it was initially just supposed to be a demonstration, right?
Yes. Yeah, it was supposed to be like a let's show the lions in action. You know, let's do a demonstration like of speed and maneuverabilities, that kind of stuff. But it kind of goes bad for Daniel when he gets showed up by two other cadets in the Galaxy Alliance Flight Academy, who end up being twin drool sisters, Rosa and Zora. I think, like, whether or not we address it directly, I'm sure the senior Voltron pilots, you know, a little red flag went up in their head as well. Like, whoa, like, is this, has anybody investigated this? Is this something that we can trust? Because we have never been able to trust, you know, any kind of gesture by the the Drool Empire in the past. But it's, you know, true to her character, Princess Alora, I think, sees the best in people and wants to embrace opportunities for peace when they come up. So she goes out of her way to really drive that point home.
She thinks those girls represent an end to the war.
Yeah, like this is a real diplomatic possibility. Like if we can like get these two to experience, you know, the freedom that we enjoy right now, they're going to go back to Planet Doom and they're going to talk about it and they're going to be representatives for peace moving forward.
When they get back to Arras,
Vince made this virtual reality game and he puts them to the test.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah, that was fun. That was a lot of fun. They're each one of the, I guess the trials that they put them through. It's like Larmina's trying to get them to fail the entire time. Like she wants to prove the point that like no matter how good you guys are, we're still from Planet Arras. You guys are Drool Empire. I don't trust you. Like, you know, and I believe she spars with both of them at some point.
Well, yeah, here's the thing. All right, they both get to wear Voltcoms. Who thinks it's okay for them to wear the Voltcoms? I would have never given them the Voltcoms.
Yeah.
But when they do wear their Voltcoms, the thing that they becomes sort of like one of their powers is an invisibility cloak.
Yes. Yeah.
Where did that come from?
Well, it shows their powers.
Yeah, it kind of...
And
The whole thing with the Voltcoms is that like they kind of tap into your latent, you know, or your personality in a sense. Like they expose your strengths.
And it chose them to be one of the stealthy, sneaky people.
Yeah. So it kind of was a little reveal that like they're hiding something, you know?
Right. Let's move on towards the end of it where we see them in the Lions with Daniel and Vince.
Yes.
And Daniel and Vince are just, I guess, I don't know. Are they enamored by these girls?
Yeah, they're a little starstruck, I think. Like, you know, at first it's Daniel, I think, leading the charge that, like, you know, they're nowhere near as good as me. But I think little by little, a little bit of a crush starts to form, you know, between both boys. Like, yeah, I think it's definitely like, you know, it's puppy love.
So they're taking a joyride, and obviously the girls are just trying to take two lions out of the picture so that they can't form Voltron, while a two-headed snake robeast shows up, and, you know, they can't form Voltron.
Yeah. And again, like, it was all part of a master plan. Like, they show the Voltron force that they're willing to help. You know, they're fighting against this robeast, a robeast that was planted there specifically to have them defeated.
And of course, there's trust issues, so they don't believe everything the girls say.
Right. Right. But by the end, when they do actually help Voltron defeat the robeast, I think it's like enough of a green light on everybody. Well, you know, they're not bad at all. They helped us there. Like, they could have totally sabotaged us, and they could have, you know, they could have helped that robeast in some capacity destroy us, but they didn't. But it really was just like an exercise in building trusts, so that way they can betray them in the future.
Right. And we'll find out later.
Yes.
All right, but we go to Rise of the Beast King.
Uh-huh.
This is like the whole history book of it.
Yeah, this is an interesting aspect, okay? Because you talk about the origins of Voltron, and you slightly change this up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
All right, because it was originally Witch Hagar who had broken Voltron up, trying to destroy him.
Right.
And broken him up into the five lions. Now, we only thought there were five pieces. There was actually six, wasn't there?
Yeah, you know, the all the watching of Go Lion, you know, the Japanese series, before I started working on the books, the origin in Go Lion is different, you know, than the one that was aired here in America. Basically, the Go-Lion origin is that Voltron is a giant robot. He is out there just like, you know, fighting against other giant monsters. Never really, you know, it's never really declared whether or not he's doing it out of some sense of duty to the universe, or if he's just like a gladiator, essentially, just fighting other monsters. Eventually, his hubris, his self-importance becomes so great that the universe... the embodiment of the universe decides to stop him. They're like, look, you have to stop doing this. And he's like, no one tells me what to do. And Voltron actually attacks the universe. Now, they use the same footage in both episodes. They use the same exact footage of, you know, Voltron attacking that angelic being in space.
Right.
But in the Golion episode, it is, that's the universe. And the universe is like, this has to stop. You've grown too powerful. You're corrupted. You know, it's like, so I'm going to break you apart and remove that element from you, that kind of corrupted arrogance. And I'm going to ensure that it will never happen again. We're going to take that spirit and, you know, lock it away. And from now on, it's going to require teamwork. It's going to require five different people working together to make Voltron work. So that way, no one entity will ever have total control of such a powerful, you know, a powerful machine.
Right.
So yeah, it was like a treating the Golion origin as a possible, you know, fairy tale that was handed down, you know, within the Voltron universe. Maybe there's some truth to it. Maybe there isn't. What exactly the Beast King is, and like how, like connecting him to the Krelshi on planet Ariel, and the Lion Riders, like why are they protecting this? Like, is there truth there? We tried to leave it kind of ambivalent, you know, as to what exactly it was. So there are possibilities there. There are definitely, like, you know, historic possibilities, much in the same way that, like, you know, the legend of Voltron was passed down from, you know, planet to planet, generation to generation, in the years between, you know, the Witch Hagar destroying him and, you know, the Space Explorers finding him again on planet Ariel, on planet Eris.
Right.
Yeah, it was a fun thing to explore, and I'm very glad they gave me the chance to do that, because I thought it was a neat story.
Yeah, when it came to the Krelshi and everything, in the TV series, we had seen the Blacksmith episode.
Yes.
When the Nexus of Black Lion was damaged.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't know what to do with it, and Pidge and Hunk were trying their best to try to repair it, but they didn't know what to do. And then they found out about, you know, the ancient, I guess, hieroglyphics or something that they saw on Ariel.
Yes, we tied into that too. I tried to, because that offers yet another alternate take on Voltron's origin, whereby there was a coalition of planets that came together, each contributing a specific piece of technology to make Voltron in the first place.
Right. So whenever I had seen anything about the Krelshi and everything, I had always thought, well, the only thing that could really use the Krelshi that was the Krelshi was the Blacksmith. Mm-hmm. And he was there to protect Voltron. He was there to make sure Voltron was, you know, 100%. Yeah. And he was made up of all the Krelshi, basically. So when we started to see this whole thing about the Beast King, and then him actually using the Krelshi, it kind of took me aback, you know, like, wow, I didn't know the Krelshi could be that, you know, be used for evil kind of thing.
The conceit in the story, I guess, is that the Krelshi are all parts of the energy that Voltron utilizes, right? Like, each one of them is like an energy being made of Voltron energy. So the Beast King, if he is who he says he is, he has dominion over that power. You know, he has the ability to, like, you know, use that energy, because he used it once before as the, you know, the spirit of Voltron.
Right.
So yeah, him absorbing it and using it for his own, you know, for his own gain, to, you know, make himself stronger so he could eventually, like, repossess the Voltron robot. That was cool. I actually enjoyed that story quite a bit.
So this was another aspect where it was sort of like fables that were handed down, you know, as stories. And Allura tells the story to the rest of the Force, and, you know, they all say, yeah, we've heard the stories and all that kind of stuff. We never thought it was real.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Chief Callan comes on the comm, and he says, you know, you need to protect yourselves, because the Beast King is back. And at the time, Allura's like, hey, you kept this from us. Why would you keep this from us? And Chief Callan's telling her, you know, this, there's not, you don't need to know everything about it, you know? And she says, well, we're going to talk about this later.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So I'd like to see what that conversation is like between Callan and Laura.
It's the origins of Voltron, like who built it, where it came from, why he was broken up into five pieces. Like, I find that all very interesting because there are like several different takes on it depending on what version of the story you're viewing or reading. So trying to like reconcile all that and collate the information so that way each one of them has a place within the Voltron canon. Like it was a lot of fun putting that together. It was a lot of fun trying to figure out how all these kind of conflicting accounts could possibly all lead to one unified account.
Right. To me, this was one of the most important volumes in your series. Because, it identifies the origin of Voltron. It also goes deep into the relationship between Mayhawx and Lotor.
Yep.
And where Mayhawx actually uses the Beast King to destroy Lotor.
Yes.
And I don't know if Mayhawx thinks this is for the last time because, you know, Lotor keeps on regenerating using Hegarium and everything.
Yeah. But Mayhawx is the one who's making that happen.
Right.
He's the one who's bringing him back, so... You know, like it or not, Lotor, no matter how badly he treats Mayhawx, Mayhawx is always the guy who has to do the resurrecting at the end of the day.
Right. And there's another aspect here where Daniel's little infection of Hegarium is brought to the forefront. And Vince is actually gets to the point where he thinks Daniel has to use his evil part of himself in order to save the whole team.
Yeah, well, in the Voltron Force series, in the TV show, the only thing that they showed that has, like, any, like, real chance of damaging Voltron in a serious way, like, in a debilitating way, is Hegarium. So as a last-ditch effort, like, well, in order to save everybody, the Beast King is running on the same energy that, you know, powers Voltron. Hegarium is capable of destroying Voltron, we have to use Hegarium to destroy the Beast King.
Hey, Lucas.
What?
Did you think if Daniel had, you know, gone on a Hegarium tirade that we would ever be able to get him back?
Probably not.
Yeah.
So were you thinking that it was a good idea for Vince to do that?
I think it was a great idea for him to do that.
Yeah. It was a gamble. You know,
yeah.
There was no guarantee that, like, they were going to be able to, like, that Vince was going to be able to, you know, bring Daniel back from that, from that dark spot. But I love that scene, the way it was drawn, where Daniel, like, just runs up and starts punching the giant Beast King.
Right.
Yeah, it was very well done by the artist.
And the Beast King was surprised that it actually hurt.
Yeah. Yep.
And somehow throughout the course of that whole thing with the Hegarium infection and everything, the rest of the team didn't know about it.
No, you know, that up until the very end of the season one, I don't think the rest of the team was fully aware of Daniel's condition. It was something that him and Vince were kind of keeping secret via their, their telepathic communications.
But throughout that whole thing, Daniel always thought that if the rest of the team found out that he would never get a chance to pilot Black Lion, that he would never get a chance to be a part of the Voltron Force.
Right.
But we all know that the rest of the team would have worked to do whatever they could to get that infection out of him.
Sure, sure.
So that they could continue on.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where he didn't want to take that chance, I guess. You know, and I thought they did a pretty good job with that in the cartoon, too, as far as... You know, the risk of revealing that versus the possible ramifications.
We move on to episode 5.
One of my favorites.
This is one of your favorites?
Yeah.
What do you like about it the most?
The dragons.
The dragons. Okay. I guess whenever you bring dragons into it, it all becomes a little bit more interesting, isn't it?
Yes.
This one out of all the books that I wrote, this one feels the most like a classic Voltron episode to me. Like, it really does have that, like the humor is there, like, the action's there, like, the threat of, like, this, you know, plague of space dragons that they bring to planet Eris.
And Hunk gets his own pet.
Yes, Hunk Jr., yeah.
for a short period of time.
Yeah. It also served to, like, you know, the connection between Hunk and the cadets on the TV show was very special. I mean, Hunk, out of all the other Voltron, you know, pilots... really made the time to get to know them on a personal level, and be friends with them, you know. And like when the cadets start, like, you know, they have their own little private hangout. Hunk wants to be in there. When they have this prank they want to pull on Lance to get back at him, Hunk wants in on that. So it really showed like the friendship dynamic between Hunk and the three cadets.
That all started with the Hunk Yard.
Yeah, and Awesome Tron, yeah.
Yeah, that as soon as you open yourself up and you show people a part of you that nobody knows about, they start to trust you more, don't they?
Yes.
So, you know, by doing that for the cadets, I think they really said, all right, we know we can trust Hunk forever here.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when it comes to playing a prank on Lance, you know, they're all for that, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah.
Hunk is, like, leading the charge.
Yeah, Hunk likes to play jokes, I think. You know, and it's like he's a big kind of, like, you know, tough dude if you have to fight him. But, like, he's really got this goofball side to him, too. You know, and I had a lot of fun writing them that way.
Okay, what are the chunky hunkies?
Go ahead,
Lincoln.
It's Hunk's famous sandwich that he makes. It's his specialty sandwich.
What's in that sandwich?
Lots of gross stuff.
Yeah, like sardines?
Yeah. Ugh.
And jalapenos?
Not a good mix.
Where did you come up with that combination?
I just, you know, I look at Hunk and I just say, like, you know, this guy probably will eat anything, you know. He's an adventurous eater. So the fact that he eats something that's like, and he enjoys it, he loves it, that's so repugnant to everybody else, I just thought was funny.
It's a taste bud tantalizing mix of sardines, blue cheese, onions, and jalapenos.
Yes.
Ugh. Wow.
Yeah, and that actually, the sandwiches actually play a central role in that whole story.
Yeah,
it was what they were going to plant in Lance's planted somewhere in Red Lion and just let it stink up the cockpit, and Lance would never know where it was coming
right
from. But also, Hunk Jr. ended up loving them, so yeah, it worked out.
It worked out great, and we saw another version of Awesome Tron in there.
Yes, yep.
And the first time that they actually form it, like they actually show the formation.
Yeah, in book two, they're already all formed. It happens like we're joining them in mid battle, but yeah,
right.
Awesome Tron, yeah, it was fun. It was fun getting to show the cadets, you know, using their ingenuity and like doing things to help Voltron, you know, from this much, you know, the smaller Awesome Tron robot.
Here we are. We're talking about a herd of dragons.
Yeah, they spawn once. I forget exactly what the time frame is, but it's like, you know, once a century or, you know, once every couple hundred years on planet Doom.
Right.
They destroy everything. Like, they're a menace. So, you know, the Lotor and Mayhawk decide, well, let's just transplant all these dragon eggs to planet Eris and they'll do all our work for us. They'll hatch and then they'll destroy the planet. They'll destroy Voltron, and then we can just like, you know, cruise on in and take over. Yeah, it's a pretty dastardly plan.
So, how did they think that they'd actually be able to lead that whole herd of dragons back to Doom?
It took the mother. It took like the mother dragon tracking down the eggs and then, you know, taking control of you know, the direction that they were going to fly in. So yeah, it's a I forget exactly how that happens. I should have reread all the books. But I believe they see the mother dragon flying, like they see it on their scopes, like coming towards the planet, and they think they're in trouble, but really it ends up being the greatest help. Once they can reunite the baby dragons with the mother, that's what they needed to happen. And then the mother's going to take them back to where they're supposed to be, like take them back to Planet Doom.
And when they get back to Planet Doom, Lotor and Mayhawk are thinking, well, by now the space dragons should have decimated them. So, you know, we're going to celebrate, right?
And then
and then there's a little present at the door.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, it's funny. Oh, I remember why we had to eliminate these dragons in the first place. Yeah,
I love the artist on that book too. He had a very different take than anything we had seen, you know, up until that point.
Albert Carreras Guardia.
Yes.
Okay.
And on to the last book.
Yeah, now we get to True Colors.
This was a lot of fun, just because I'm very good friends with Jacob Chabot. We've known each other for years and years. We used to work at Marvel Comics together. And I genuinely believe him to be like one of the finest American cartoonists currently working today. He came on board with the first book. I would love to have him do all six, but they're massive undertakings for a comic book artist. Each one of these books is like, you know, 90 pages.
Right.
It takes a huge chunk of time for someone to do it. And on the schedule that Viz was releasing the books, it didn't make sense for Jacob unless he cloned himself, you know, to be able to do all six.
Yeah, when you think about it, these are really called graphic novels.
Yes.
Because they really make up what could be an actual TV episode.
Yeah, no, it was for the amount of pages that we were putting in these books and the price point, I thought it was a great opportunity for anybody who's interested in the show to get like a substantial chunk of entertainment. You know, to really they're not like monthly comics. It's, you know, this is like an entire like 4-issue series in one book.
Right. And these weren't just available at comic book stores. These were available at bookstores.
Yes.
So you could get them at Barnes & Noble. You could get them through Amazon. You could get them anywhere. So you brought Jacob back.
Yeah, Jacob was able to come back and do the sixth book. And, you know, being that when we started, like I really did envision book one and book six as kind of being the bookends, the beginning and ending of like, you know, the immediate stories that we were telling in the Voltron Force comics. It was a treat to get him back, you know, to do the sixth volume. And he did an amazing job.
And this sixth volume has everything in it. I mean, you've got
different formations of the Lions, like Red Center.
Right.
Yep.
And you've got Alora and Keith and Pidge dressed in their royal wear.
Yes.
And they're doing something separately than the rest of the group's doing.
Yep.
The cadets are, you know, dealing with some returning members from a previous issue.
Yep. Yep.
You've got Kyborg and Dagger and
Drazik.
Yeah. We get to bring like pretty much all the heavies back. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly when book six came out. I do not think in the cartoon series that Larmina and Pidge and Keith had formally handed off the Lions. So it kind of ended up being a nice little moment, like where we allude to what's happening in the future, where, you know, they've relinquished like the piloting roles and they're going off to do the diplomatic and technological, you know, aspects of what they want to do.
Of course, we get the twins back again.
Yes.
Did you ever watch Seinfeld?
Yeah, sure.
Do you remember the very final episode of Seinfeld?
Yes, with trial, when everybody that they've ever done anything weird or wrong to comes back.
Yeah. It just seemed like the whole cast of characters came back for the final episode. That's what it seemed like.
Hopefully, we're paying off the setups of, like, you know, the Drool twins kind of insinuating themselves in the cadets' lives, where they wouldn't question what they were doing. They wouldn't, like, you know, think they were up to anything dastardly, because they've already proven themselves to be allies. And we also have, like, you know, at the end of the Tournament of Lions book, we see the Elder Council approaching Lotor on Planet Doom and just saying, like, look, we're going to help you. We're not done with Voltron yet. We want to have a greater say in what's going on there, and we're in your service now. We'll help you out with whatever you need if we can get Voltron. So, like, all the little cliffhangers that we peppered throughout the entire six-book series, like, all of that comes back in the final book.
Alora and Keith and Pidge all go to Halicron.
Yes.
Because they think it's going to be some kind of peacemaking type of venture.
Yeah, a global, interplanetary peace conference, like when they are going to go there to represent Eris.
Right. And when they get there, they get to see that it's Mayhawx and the Drools that are really just setting a trap for them.
Yes. And then they fake their own deaths.
That was Pidge's idea, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They send that transport ship up into the air to intentionally get it blown up. So that way the perception would be that they were, you know, killed flying, trying to escape.
And Drazik uses that perception against the cadets when the cadets are captured to make them think that they were killed.
Yeah, and then it's hopeless. Like, you know, we've already taken out three of the senior members. There's nothing you kids can do. But, you know, it was probably the worst movie could have made because it just fueled them to, you know, to get out there and help.
Yeah. During the course of this, the twins think they've done a good job for their uncle.
Yes.
And he tells them that Mahox has other things that he needs
right, they're not
for.
Done. They're not done with their part of the plan yet, yeah.
But it isn't what they bargained for, is it?
No, it isn't. And, you know, that was a tricky way, you know, the ending of that, because I think in the original version I had written, Voltron destroys the twins, like destroys the twin Robies.
In the original version?
Yeah, the first draft that I had written.
Oh, wow.
I believe that, like, it was a finality there. Like, you know, they actually were destroyed. It's weird, like, with the Robeasts in the classic series, you know, occasionally you'll see a pilot being loaded into a Robeast, and then there's, like the Urak Robeast.
Yeah.
Literally was just, like, a giant version of him. You know, like, there was no little him piloting a bigger version of him.
Right.
So, I think in the first draft it was the twins would survive, but the Robeasts would be destroyed. But then once, like, you know, we thought about it, well, they really wouldn't be piloting these Robeasts. They would, in fact, be the Robeasts themselves. Like, there would not be an escape route for a pilot.
Right. So, like Commander Kala had been in the TV show.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was a way to show how compassionate, like, Allura and specifically Larmina had become by sparing them, with the hope that eventually someday maybe they can be cured or, you know, reverted back to their, you know, their humanoid forms.
All right. So it was a little confusing for me towards the end there when they made Blue Center.
Yes.
And then she froze both of them.
Yep.
What happened to them after they were frozen?
We don't know. We don't know.
Yeah.
Whether or not Mahox was able to, you know, once they were unfrozen, if they have been corralled and are, you know, currently being held as Robeasts, whether or not, you know, they were destroyed by Lotor as failures, whether there was a way for them to be reverted back to human. It really was up to the Drool Empire to decide.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of a scary thing to leave it up to them.
Yeah, but, you know, the good thing is that with a lot of the villains specifically, like, that you introduce, you never want them to go away completely. You know, you're robbing the catalog of available characters. So you can mess with them really badly, and you can hurt them, and they can appear to die. But, like, really, I think you want the opportunity, or at least the option, to be able to bring them back at some point in some capacity. So they're there, you know, if there's a Voltron force, Voltron Extreme Force, whatever, you know, coming up.
Right.
Those characters are there for whoever's next to play with.
All right. So what did you think when DreamWorks took over Classic Media's license and is now acquired Classic Media and it has now become DreamWorks Classics?
Uh-huh.
What do you think the possibilities are out there for more stories like this?
I hope there are. You know, I think the latest incarnation on Nickelodeon, the Voltron Force cartoon, showed that there is an interest. You know, there's a loyal fan community that exists, and there's really an endless opportunity to bring in new fans.
Like Lucas?
Exactly. You know, it's the visual hooks everybody. The visual of Voltron is very iconic and very strong, and people inherently, I think, want to know more about what that is.
Lucas, I want to ask you, if they were to bring out another version of Voltron that's not the same as the original Voltron, it's not Voltron the Third Dimension, it's not Voltron Force, but it's a totally new perspective on Voltron, would you be up for watching that?
Probably.
Yeah?
I might be interested in it to see how the story goes.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the coolest part about Voltron?
Blazing guns.
Blazing guns?
Oh,
really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I would have thought you would have said Tech Ninja Voltron.
Oh, yeah, that was one of my favorite
parts. Boomerang Shield.
The first part where they formed Green Center inside the music episode.
Yeah.
When I was reading the scripts, you know, I didn't know much about what they were planning. They showed me some of the visuals of the new takes on the lions, and I thought they were really cool. But once I started reading the scripts and I saw what they were planning as far as, you know, the flash forming and the different center configurations, I got giddy. Like, I was like, that's exactly, I've always thought that from when I was a kid. I'm like, why does it always have to be black center?
You know, right.
I'm sure, like, the same way everybody's like, what if there was another lion? Like, what if there was a sixth lion that we've never seen? You know, there's just like these real core questions that, like, you get as a fan.
But as a writer, you don't like to limit yourself, right?
No. You want to have, like, you know, all avenues open, obviously, within reason. You know, you don't want to do anything that directly contradicts the message of the property and, like, you know, the what they're trying to achieve with the stories they're telling.
So, yeah, I think the idea of always having black center was that people thought that, well, black's a bigger lion than the other lions.
Yes.
So how could any of the other lions possibly get into center and be able to do the same things that black lion did?
Right.
I think that was what was holding people back.
Mm-hmm.
From thinking about that.
Yeah, the fact that, like, they were actually able to do it convincingly on the show, that it looks cool, and, like, you know, there wasn't any kind of, like, oh, well, black lion's now, like, the black lion leg is, you know, 100 feet longer than
right
than the other legs. Like, it works, you know. It was very cool to look at.
Okay. I wanted to give Lucas a chance to...
I wish I was Voltron.
Well, Daniel was Voltron one time,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Yeah, one of the episodes.
Yeah. All right, so I wanted to give Lucas a chance to ask you some questions.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead, Lucas.
In the Voltron Force TV show, what makes Voltron different from other cartoons?
Well, I think, you know, you look at other robot cartoons that have existed, you know, obviously, like, the you know, the biggest example probably being Transformers. And while there are, like, you know, Transformers that, you know, combine into larger Transformers, I think the human element is what separates Voltron from those other shows. You know, actually having to have a pilot, actually having to have people making decisions behind the robot's actions. You know, the robots themselves, even though they've hinted at some kind of, you know, sentience or autonomy that the lions do have, realistically, it always boils down to the pilots being skilled and them trying to, you know, pilot these lions and form Voltron and save the day. So I think that's the biggest difference, is that, like, you know, there's a true human connection between, like, the pilots and Voltron, as opposed to something like Transformers.
Are there other cartoons that you watch right now?
I just got done watching the first season of Attack on Titan, and I really enjoyed that quite a bit. That was something it's a Japanese cartoon.
Right.
With a trope of giant things that are attacking smaller things. But it was something I'd never really heard about, and all of a sudden everybody I knew, like fellow writers and, you know, guys that I read comics with, whatever, they were all talking about it at once. You know, it, like, just kind of came out of nowhere and became, like, this big cultural phenomenon. But I really enjoyed that. That's probably the most recent thing I've watched.
Okay. Yeah. What else do you like to watch? It doesn't have to be cartoons.
I watch a lot of dramas on TV now. It just seems like a very golden age for, you know, for television. I watch The Walking Dead. I enjoy that quite a bit. Let's see. I'm watching True Detective right now. I think that's excellent, as mm-hmm. does the rest of the universe. I really enjoyed Breaking Bad when that was on.
Right.
I do watch a couple sitcoms. I like The Big Bang Theory. I watch it, like, in endless reruns, it seems. Anytime it's on, I'll watch an episode, and there's always an episode on.
Lucas, tell them one of the lines from Big Bang Theory.
Penny. Penny.
I need one more.
One more Penny. Come on. Knocking Penny.
Penny.
Okay.
Oof. Good.
Yeah. It's almost like you don't feel like you're complete unless you hear it three times in a row.
But I'm primarily, besides, like, you know, writing and drawing, I've been reading a lot of Marvel Omnibus editions, like the older material from the 60s and 70s. And I have a mild IDW artist addiction that I'm currently struggling with. I love those books. I don't know if you've seen them. They're like the oversized collections, like, of scanned artwork, like the original artwork boards from different artists.
I actually haven't seen those.
They are fantastic, but they are big, and they take up a lot of room. And I mentioned my very small apartment in New Jersey. So one of them, there's a couple of them based on the old EC comics. You know, I have a Jack Davis EC Comics collection. There's a Mad collection. They're beautiful books. Essentially, it's authentic reproductions of the artwork at the size the artist worked at. So for these, some of the older magazines, the boards are huge. You know, they're, like almost 3 feet tall.
Wow.
So it's like collections of that artwork. And as a comic book artist, you know, I find them like an invaluable tool because I get to look at art that I would never be able to afford to buy an individual piece of. But yet here's an entire, like, you know, collection of it. You learn a lot just by looking at it.
Okay. Lucas, why don't you go on with your next question?
Seeing that I'm 10 and I love Legos, do you happen to know if they will make a Lego Voltron with transforming lions?
I do not know that. I support that 100%, though. I think it's great. And, you know, I'm sure if you investigated it, somebody's already, like, figured out a way to build it. But, yeah, I would love that, especially with all these, like, kind of the more collector-based sets I've seen lately. I saw the Back to the Future, the DeLorean with Marty and Doc.
Right.
I think they're doing a Ghostbusters set with, like, you know, Ecto-1 and the four Ghostbusters.
Right.
So, you know, getting Lego minifigs of the pilots would be amazing.
It's a really big time for Lego licenses this time around, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's like me and my wife, Sarah, were talking yesterday after we left the movie. It's probably the only time you will ever see a movie that has Batman, Gandalf, Michelangelo from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you know, Wonder Woman. It's like all these properties and all these universes kind of all fit in the Lego universe. It's great.
Yeah, I think it's amazing, and I'd like to see a Voltron Lego.
Yeah, me too.
All right, next one, Lucas.
This is probably a yes, but do you know anything about Beast King Golan?
Yes, I watched the entire series right when I started writing Voltron Force. I was already pretty familiar with the Voltron Defender of the Universe series, but
you watched that when you were a kid, right?
Yeah, and you know, I've seen them, like, you know, they're streaming now, and you know, I rewatched the Fleet of Doom movie, and but I really was unfamiliar with the original Japanese series, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
Okay, we have one more question for you?
I think I'm done.
You think you're done?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we wanted to ask you about the 30th anniversary book.
Sure.
You've been writing that for a while now, and it's getting close to the point where it has to go through the design, layout, and publishing part, right?
Yep. Yeah, I've already, it's unlike anything else I've ever written. The parts that I'm writing are kind of like a fictional archive from the Galaxy Alliance documenting their knowledge and understanding of what Voltron is. You know, based on, like, it's almost like writing a textbook for a history that doesn't exist. So
right.
it's taking all the pieces and all, like, the planets and all the characters and all that stuff that's presented in the cartoon and in the comics and, you know, the Voltron Force comics that I wrote, and kind of assigning, like, context and history to all of it.
So putting it in a structure that makes sense so that everybody can look through it and find what they need to know about a certain something within the universe, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know how much you're allowed to talk about it, but is there any things that you can say about it? And maybe you might even know, like, when it might be available?
I don't have a release date yet. They might have one. I'm sure they have a plan, but I don't know when exactly the book is coming out.
I was thinking, you know, maybe like in August or September. I don't even know if that's a good target.
Oh, I don't know. You know, hopefully it'll be out in time for one of the major conventions.
Right.
So that way they could have a panel about it.
That'd be great. Have you been invited to go to any of the conventions this summer?
You know, I tend to do. I haven't been out to San Diego in many, many years, just because it's a very long trip and it's such a long show, and it's great. I think as a fan, you know, just soaking it all in and getting to walk around and see all that great stuff. But trying to, like, you know, meet up with people or conduct any kind of business is always a futile effort at that show. It's just
right.
It's exhausting getting from one end of the convention to the other. And sometimes just getting in and out of the show is, you know, hours long waits, lines. So, yeah. As a fan, I encourage everybody to go check that show out at least once, purely just to walk the show floor and enjoy it. But I tend to do most of the East Coast shows now. It's just easier for me. Typically, you could find me at Baltimore. Baltimore Comic Con is always a great show. I did the Comic Book City Con, the first one ever this year in Greensboro, North Carolina. I live right outside of New York City, so you know, I go to the New York City Comic Con. That's always a great show.
Yeah, we've seen you there a couple times.
Yeah, yeah. Mostly East Coast shows at this point, though.
All right. So, as part of the 30th anniversary book, there was a lot of people wondering about how they might finish the Voltron Force story. Is that going to be a part of that book?
That will be a part of the book. I was actually provided the initial story bible that Todd Garfield had created for what would have been season two, and Jacob Chabot, who's, like I said before, one of my favorite artists of all time, he's going to be drawing it. And there will be a comic supplement at the end that shows the new status quo that would have started with season two and, like, alludes to all the things that, hopefully all the things that they would have done in season two of the cartoon.
We also have a contingent of fans that we had asked to ask you questions. And we posted it on the Facebook page for Let's Voltron Podcast. And we asked them to send in some questions. And we said that at the end of asking all these questions, we would allow you to choose which one of those questions a person would be able to get a signed copy of one of the six volumes that you had written.
You're going to make me choose?
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
We've done this before, and it's always based on, you know, what you think are the most interesting questions.
Great. I'm down.
So, all right. So, on Facebook, we have, Claire Kaltman had asked, I know that you had a certain target age group, when it came to writing those comics. How easy is it to maintain writing in that range? And were you tempted to go a little mature at times?
Yeah, I get asked that. I think I've been asked that a couple times, even on panels. You know, the Voltron Force cartoon, while there are, like, you know, Easter eggs and, like, you know, like nods to the older show, it really was, you know, aimed at a certain age range. It was aimed at, you know, kids. So the comics that I wrote based on the show all fit into that. And I honestly don't really have a hard time kind of doing that kind of work. It's typically what I do anyway. I try to make all of my writing, when I write comics or draw comics of my own, accessible to anybody. I'm pretty selfish like that. I want everybody reading my comics. So I don't want to put anything in there that, like, would raise a red flag for, like, a parent possibly buying the comic for their kid, or, you know, anything that would turn people off. I want everybody to, like, be able to pick this up and enjoy it. You hear, like, the Pixar model, you know, what they try to do with their films and how they try to make them entertaining for everybody. And I really do try to do that with my writing. So, okay, you know, being able to write Voltron Force, it wasn't like I had to, you know, dumb down, like, you know, some mature things that I was trying to do. Like, I really just want to tell exciting action stories.
And I think one of the biggest compliments you said was that you basically could have taken any one of those volumes and turned it into an episode, and it would have fit right in with those characters and with the target audience as well.
No, that was great to hear, because, you know, that was the goal. The goal was to, you know, create a companion piece that would, like, show bits of the characters and, like, decisions and, you know, the relationships they have that maybe, like, they would not get to explore on the show due to the time limits, you know? So, yeah, that was a great compliment. I'm still very proud about that.
Okay, our next question is from Chris Navarro on Facebook. He had wanted to know what artist you were selecting for the 30th anniversary issue, and you said Jacob, right?
Yeah, Jacob's on board. Jacob is drawing the season two comic.
Okay, and he also wanted to know how were the artists chosen for the six issues of the Viz Media Voltron Force series?
Jacob got involved literally because I showed his stuff to Tracy, and Jacob is a huge Voltron fan. I think he dressed up as Green Lion one Halloween. He had a picture and he showed everybody. But it was, again, it was like, you know, this very early influence and this opportunity to work and contribute to something that we all care about. So Jacob was, you know, anytime I have a job and they need a great cartoonist, I always think of Jacob.
But all right, how about Alpha Robbie?
A lot of the guys were, I don't know if they'd previously done work for Viz in some capacity, but Tracy really handled all the other, you know, assigning all the other artists.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was. They were all like, you know, professional guys that worked in a certain style, and Tracy contacted all the rest of those guys.
Okay, so we're talking about issue 2 was Dario Brizuela.
Yep.
Issue 3 was Horacio Dominguez, mm-hmm. Pedro Pablo Perez Valiente.
Yep.
And issue 5 was Albert Carreras Guardia.
Yes.
Issue 4 was Alpha Robbie.
Yes.
So, so it wasn't really your choice in all those then.
No, you know, when you're hiring an artist, especially for like a what I consider to be a pretty big undertaking, it's not like most monthly comics that come out are 20 pages, 22 pages. So you're expected to turn that around. Like if you're a penciler, you know, a 22 page comic should take you roughly 30 days. So like that's like a monthly comic schedule. This right. is, you know, 4 times that. So you need to budget the time that you have. You need to block out like 2 or 3 months to draw this whole book. So a lot of times it boils down to interest and availability. Like, are you interested in this? Can you make the time to do it? Because it's a pretty large commitment.
Okay.
And Tracy handled all that.
Gotcha. Okay. Casey Snyder wants to know, what kind of challenges did you face adapting the stories to graphic novels?
None. Because I wrote them all as graphic novels. So, you know, it wasn't like when you're adapting like if I was doing adaptations of the cartoons, if like we were adapting specific episodes into graphic novels, that would have been something different. You know, it would have been taking all the information that they present in the show and then pacing it and applying it to the graphic novel format. But since, you know, I was writing them as original graphic novels, you know, they were built that way from the beginning.
Right, so you just had it in your mind, oh, okay, what story can I take the Voltron Force through this like it was a typical episode?
Yes.
Okay. Cubbyberry wants to know, Viz Media launched Sticky Dot for iPad for Voltron Force comics. When will there be an e-comics set for Android devices, and do you know if there will be?
Oh, I'm the wrong guy to ask about that, unfortunately. I don't know like what their, you know, as a company, I don't know what they're planning. I'm just a, you know, a freelance writer. That was lucky right. to get this gig.
Would there be a plans to release more comics other than the 6 issues?
To my knowledge,
that you know of?
Just the 30th anniversary book is going to be another comic, you know, written by me and drawn by Jacob. But beyond that, I have no idea. I would love to do okay. more. You know, it's a great series, and I really love the character. So any opportunity there would be to do more, I would jump to do it.
Okay. Would there have been any chance for, you know, and we bring this back again, for Larmina's heritage to be revealed, you know, that Daniel's Hagarium infection would be cured, that Keith and Allura would become king and queen and all that kind of stuff?
Without addressing any one of those things specifically, I would say get the 30th anniversary book.
There you go. Okay. All right. Well, you know, would you have time later on this year that we could actually talk about that book in more detail when it gets time for that to come out?
Oh, sure. Like a postmortem? Yeah, sure. That'd be great.
Because, I'd love to be able to talk about the book in more detail, and we can't obviously do that right now.
Yeah.
The timing isn't right for that.
The part I just finished the book that I was really, it was so much fun writing it, you know, hopefully I won't get in trouble for spoiling this little bit, but there's a complete guide to like all the Robies that have appeared, you know, as part of the Voltron Encyclopedia. So right. I got the chance to, a lot of these guys have no names and like, you know, there's not a defined, you know, a weapons capabilities and all that stuff. I actually had to make up like a bunch of stuff for that. And I was really, really happy with the way it turned out.
Well, that's good. That was a really nice tease for the fans. So thank you for that.
Sure.
We'd like to know, the other stuff you worked on besides the Voltron Force comics and the 30th anniversary book. What else have you worked on, and what are you currently working on?
Oh, sure. I'm currently working on, I have a creator-owned comic that I co-write with my friend Mike Raich called The Stuff of Legend. The second collection, the second omnibus of that series was just released last month. And we've had some very, very good news on that front. We've sold the rights to Disney, and they're currently developing it for a major motion picture. So we're all very fingers crossed and very excited about that. And now, it continues to go in a great direction. Everybody involved so far is really stoked about where it's going. So, yeah, we're pretty excited about that. I also I write and draw another creator-owned book called The Intrepid Scapegoat through Third World Studios, about the world's greatest escape artist who happens to be a goat. And he travels the world with his stage act, but also debunks like paranormal mysteries and phenomena as he goes.
Lucas was just laughing when you said he just happens to be a goat.
Oh, you would love it, Lucas. You would love it. I wrote 4 issues of that, and that's been collected into a trade paperback. And that's available, comic bookstores, Amazon, wherever. I just recently wrote an issue of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles animated adventure series for IDW. I think it was issue 7 that came out last month. Right. And hopefully I have some more of that coming.
Is there anywhere where we'd be able to see some of your artwork?
Oh, yeah. You could look at, I have a website called briansmithcomics.com. And that's got a gallery of past stuff. Probably desperately needs to be updated with current stuff that I'm working on. But
There's not always time for that, is there?
No. So, it's a quality problem to have. You're too busy doing to talk about what you're doing.
Right.
Yeah. So that Turtles issue I wrote, I contributed some artwork for our Bravest Warriors collection that's coming out through Viz later this year. I also contributed a 3-page story to a Hello Kitty collection that's coming out from the Hello Kitty comics that Viz is doing. I'm also a semi-regular contributor to SpongeBob comics that come out through Bongo. I have a 2-page story coming up there, and I'm doing some more writing for them. So yeah, staying busy. And a couple other creator-owned things and a couple other things I just can't talk about at this point.
Now, I wanted to congratulate you, number one, on the movie deal.
Oh, thanks.
I know how these things go, and that it could be a long time before something comes out.
Yes.
And you always got to keep your fingers crossed that it keeps going.
Yep.
But I just wanted to congratulate you on that.
Thank you.
Did you get to choose who your artist was for Stuff of Legend?
Stuff of Legend came about in a really kind of great organic way. Me and Mike were both former Marvel Comics editors. Mike was actually my intern for one summer. And we just hit it off. We had very similar ideas about what we thought comics could accomplish. Similar ideas about, what would make a good comic. And me and him, we both left staff right around the same time. We kept in touch, and we kept generating ideas together. Stuff of Legend was one of those ideas. And we were looking for a publisher. We shopped it around. People were largely uninterested. And then we found a smaller publisher, Third World Studios, that was looking to branch out and do something a little bit bigger than they had done in the past. The publisher at Third World, Mike DeVito, knew an artist, Charles Paul Wilson III, which sounds like a very fancy name, but he really is one of the most down-to-earth dudes you'll meet. So Charles Paul Wilson III was a recent graduate of the Kubert School here in New Jersey, the Joe Kubert School, which is a school dedicated to sequential art and comic book storytelling. Charles was a different kind of artist. I wouldn't categorize him as a traditional superhero guy. He does beautiful, beautiful pencil renderings, and he was just looking for something, a book to work on. He wanted to make an artistic statement with what he was doing. So we went to Mike. Mike knew him, and we were all in the right place at the right time. So, yeah, it kind of came about perfectly after a few stops and starts elsewhere. Once we landed at Third World, the book really took off.
And as a result of a movie thing going on, what are the possibilities for things to happen in addition to that? if that were to become successful?
Like in what way?
Like would there be more stories that would go along? Like, you know, whenever you see a great TV show or a great movie, there's always the chance for more comic stories to come out. You know, all kinds of you know, accessories and things like that to happen along the way.
Sure, sure. I mean, we're hoping that, like, the movie A gets made and B is phenomenally successful and everybody in the world goes to see it. And once that happens, yeah, we definitely have more comic stories planned, regardless of that, actually. You know, the thing with me and Mike is we wrote the whole story before it even started getting published. So we know exactly what the ending is, and we know where all the characters leave off, and we already have kind of a loose plan as to what we would do post this story. The original comics, which are still being done, it's going to be a 3 hardcover set. When it's all said and done, the first 2 are out, and now we're working on completing the last one. From what I can tell, I'm not exactly sure like how far a movie would get into that story, whether it would be all encompassing, whether they do a movie that tells the story of all 3 of those volumes or partially. But either way, like, you know, we're prepared to tell our story and to continue it if possible.
All right. This is something that we like to ask of artists and writers and everybody. If somebody wanted to get into the line of work that you're doing, all right, what is your best advice on how they can get started?
Well, you know, it's a very different place, comics, now from when I first started reading comics to the way comics are made and distributed today. It's so much easier to have an idea, execute it, and get it in front of people now, you know, with the advent of web comics and, you know, digital comics, people being able to read comics on their devices, you know, tablets and phones.
Right.
You know, when I started reading comics, you had to physically go to in my case, I went to a 7-Eleven. I would buy comics off the rack, you know.
Right.
But nowadays, it's like, it's instant. And the catalog of material that you could read instantly is vast. You know, there's so many comics out there, whether it's through Comixology, whether it's through dedicated apps, you know, from the companies. You really, like, all you have to have is an interest to read it, and you could pretty much access whatever you need right away. So if you're making comics, you could totally use that to your advantage. You know, you can create a webcomic. You do not need to, you know, have a publisher to say yes or no to your idea. If you believe in it, you can just make it and see what happens. You know, get a website and post it. You know, there's very little cost involved besides your time and the materials you would need to make the comics. But then again, so much stuff is being created solely digitally at this point. It's a really good time to kind of make comics. If you want to do like Marvel or DC superhero stuff, if your dream is to write Batman, Spider-Man, or anything like that, I would recommend trying to get an internship at one of these companies. I did that, and it really is an incredible firsthand experience on the nuts and bolts of how comic books, monthly superhero comic books, are made. You see like all the different processes. You see the people that are involved, how something goes from an idea on paper to a printed comic book every month. So for me, it was an invaluable tool. You learn a lot about discipline and, you know, how to do this on a regular basis. And if your goal is to, like, you know, write that stuff and you don't have the opportunity to be an intern at Marvel or DC, they want to see that you can make comics. They want to see that you have ideas and that you can execute those ideas. Most writers, specifically writers that get hired to write those books today, have written well-received, critically acclaimed independent comics before they are brought on board at Marvel or DC. So bottom line is, if you want to make comics, if you want to make that your life, just start making comics.
You know? So should you start by writing comics and then posting them yourself, you know, through like a blog or something like that? Or should you try to push those to publishers?
I think, you know, the current climate is that publishers want to see that you are capable of doing good work. And the only way to prove that you're capable of doing good work is to do good work. So however that work is achieved, whether it's on your website, whether it's like, you know, you running off photocopies and, you know, bringing them to a con, selling them at your local comic book store. You know, the process by which you can get the attention of an editor doesn't seem to have changed so much. It's like you just have to show that you can produce good work.
Right. All right. Well, we want to thank you for joining us on the Let's Voltron podcast.
Oh, and man.
We do look for...
This has been a blast. You know, ever since you contacted me about getting on board, I've been looking forward to it. So thank you for making the time to talk to me.
Well, at this point, we need to choose one of those questions.
They all win. They all get a signed comic. I have plenty.
Really?
Sure.
Oh, wow. Well, that's great. Oh,
grand
okay.
Prize, jackpot. Thank you.
Look at that.
Yeah, well, thank you to everybody for taking the time to write the questions. I'm glad that they're interested in, you know, the behind-the-scenes stuff, and they've continued to support Voltron. You know, so it's the least I can do, honestly.
Wow, that's really great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Wow. Hey, Lucas, is there anything else you wanted to say?
Not really, except for Let's Voltron.
Well, we're going to do that at the end. What do you think about being on the podcast for the first time?
It was a very different experience. It was sort of cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's mostly because of me.
Yeah. Isn't it cool being able to talk to somebody that actually worked on a comic book for Voltron?
Yes.
And now is writing the definitive encyclopedia for Voltron?
Yes. It's very interesting.
That is amazing.
Cool. Lucas, you did great, man. You did a great job.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think you did super, dude. All right, well, that's going to end it for us here on Let's Voltron podcast. I want to thank Brian Smitty Smith for joining us, and we look forward to talking to you again later this year.
Oh, me too. It's going to be a good year for Voltron.
Yes, it is. The 30th anniversary year of Voltron. We're looking forward to more exciting things happening.
Cool.
All right. Thank you once again. Lucas, do you want to join me in saying Let's Voltron?
Yes.
One, two, three.
Let's Voltron.